Translation in purport by Srila Prabhupada. The city gateway, the household doors and festooned arches along the roads were all nicely decorated with festive signs, like plantain trees and mango leaves, all to welcome the Lord. Flags, garlands, and painted signs and slogans all combined to shade the sunshine. Purport. Signs of decoration in special festivals were also collected from the gifts of nature, such as the plantain trees, the mango trees, fruits and flowers. Mango trees, coconut palms, and plantain trees are still accepted as auspicious signs. The flags mentioned above were all painted with the picture of either Garuda or Hanuman, the two great servitors of the Lord. For devotees, such paintings and decorations are still adored, and the servitor of the Master is paid more respect for the satisfaction of the Lord. This is how Krishna is greeted in Sri Dwarka. We don't read how when Krishna comes home with the cowherd boys in the evening in Vraja, that they put out signs and garlands and, you know, Purna Kumbhas, full pots, you know, with, decorated with mango leaves. No, life is more simple in Vraja. They greet Krishna and his friends with spontaneous love. Here, the displays of love in Dwarka are somewhat more formal, almost like in the mood of Vaikuntha, where there's many signs of honor and respect. But that's also love of Krishna. It's Krishna in a different mood. The devotees are in somewhat a different mood, not exactly the mood of Vraja. But still, it's pure love. And therefore, therefore, Sugadeva Goswami, or here, Suta Goswami, is including it in the narration of the Bhagavatam. This is our introduction to the Bhagavatam in this first canto. Krishna actually will not appear again in the Bhagavatam until the 10th canto. He'll be remembered by Uddhava at the beginning of the 3rd canto, but the actual leelas of Krishna won't be described. Only leelas of various avatars throughout the 9 first cantos. So over 30 different avatars. But Krishna himself will not show himself again until some 8,000 verses later. 8,000 verses is the size of some of the other Puranas. It's a whole book separating us from Krishna. But here we're shown Krishna, but curiously, Krishna at the end of his pastimes. Not baby Krishna in Gokula, but Krishna in Dwarka just months probably before he leaves this world. He's already done everything. He's already killed all the demons. He's already conquered everything to be conquered. He's already established his dynasty completely. Very curious that the Bhagavatam begins with the end of Krishna's Leela. This is civilization, to show respect to those who deserve respect, is the foundation of human civilization. Even apart from actual God consciousness, just human behavior requires that elders and honorable persons, kings, teachers, parents, even older brothers and sisters must be shown respect, and the respect should be shown in certain ways, not whimsically. Respect is a sign of love, but it's the love shown by the subordinate person to the superior. The superior can maintain, guide, and teach the younger person. The older person should be supported, respected, honored, and listened to. That's human civilization. Even among those, I'm not insulting anybody because there's nobody Chinese in our school yet. Even those who don't have, or atheists, in the Chinese language, at least the dictionary maker says there's no word for God in the Chinese language. You know, they have a symbol for Om, for in front of an Omkar. They use the swastika as the Chinese character for Om. Backward swastika. No, regular swastika. But there's no proper word for personality of God in the Chinese language. They're atheists. Buddhism is actually a later import into China. The older, if you want to call it religion or ethical culture of China, is simply this Confucianism. Kongzi was this teacher who was simply emphasizing respect for elders. That was the whole religion. But that's civilization. It's not really spiritual consciousness. But without that, without respect for your parents, your teachers, your elders, then you're an uncivilized two-legged animal. What is it? Dharma vihina? Oh. Pashu bhiksamadam. How's it go? Anyway. Dharma vihina pashu bhiksamana. Those who don't have any civilized behavior are no better than animals. We hear this so many times from Prabhupada. The animals sleep, eat, have sex, and fight. Human beings who don't have spiritual life are just doing what animals do. And functionally, they're just two-legged animals. Dharma begins. Deva Guru, Deva Dvija Guru Pragya Pujanam. This is... Sharira Tapa Uchyate? Which one is it? Anyway, this is the foundation of civilized behavior. To show honor to the gods, demigods, the brahmanas, one's elders and teachers. This is the foundation of Vedic civilization. Where is there any Vedic anything if there's no respect for the Vedas, or for the demigods, sages, and brahmanas who are shown in a position, a superior position in the Vedas? If you don't accept the authority of the scripture, then you're not a civilized human being. There are attempts at having other religions beside the Vedic religion, other scriptures. They're reflections of the original Vedic religion, Vedic scripture. They also propose respect for the gods, respect for the teachers. Show me a bona fide religion that denies respect for the gods and respect for the teachers. What kind of religion is that? Of course, that's the modern religion that is taught in the universities. Question everything and subject everything to your own critical analysis. And forget any gods or even don't even show any respect to your teachers. This is atheistic religion. Under the guise of scholarly critical analysis and pluralism, it's actually just atheism. Atheism doesn't just mean to deny that there's a God. There's a deeper root to that. Gnostica in the tradition of the Vedic Vedas means not to trust the authority of the Vedic literature. A Nastika basically is someone who doesn't accept the authority of the Vedas. And not accepting the authority of God comes automatically with that. What if you don't accept the Vedic authority, then you won't learn why to respect God. You won't have any idea what God is. Your whatever idea you may have of God will just be speculative and anthropomorphic or zoomorphic or nomorphic. You'll make up some idea of God as some creature with a cat's head, or some imitation of yourself in the mirror, or something with no head, formless and impersonal. You'll concoct some idea of God. Unless you can receive the true image of God, the true understanding of what is God, that's based on his actual revelation, that God has displayed himself. He has come to this world in his avatars. He has shown who and what he is. And that has been described by Vyasadeva and other Vedic rishis in the authorized shastras, in the Vedas, in the Bhagavatam, in the Upanishads. We have descriptions of the personality of God in his avatars. What is being described is what actually was observed in this world. It's empirical. Just like a scientist, Mendeleev, proved the laws of heredity. He didn't know about genes, but he didn't know what they were, chromosomes and genes. But he could see that there's something being transmitted from the parents to their offspring that determine the configuration of their bodies and their constitution. And he made up laws of genetics from his observations. He sat down with beans and counted which ones are black and which ones are white. The beans you start with some black beans and some white beans. And beans, I guess, just propagate by pollen. Anyway, he looked at the next generation of beans and counted how many are white and how many are black. And he spent thousands of hours counting beans and other small things to try to observe empirically what are the actual principles of genetics, of the transmission of qualities from one generation to the next. He did it by observation. Then he deduced, or he inferred, some principles, general laws of genetics. And most of the biologists in the world today ascribe to his theories. They're still, almost 200 years later, accepted as valid, based on empiric observation and then some attempt to make a logical system based on what you've observed. That's supposed to be scientific. You make observations and you try to draw generalizations that explain why what has happened and what is happening and why it's happening. So by that standard of science, what the Vedas are teaching us about the personality of God is also scientific. In the same way, there is the phenomena of the Lord's avatar. Some of them occurred many millions of years ago. I'm trying to reconstruct the older history of the human race just by looking at the Puranas and the Mahabharata and Ramayana. According to certain shastras, Puranas and the Ramayana itself, Lord Ramachandra appeared at the very end of Treta Yuga, which would make his appearance about 870,000 years ago. But then I read last night in some book that doesn't have proper references, but the author claims that it wasn't this Divya Yuga, it was the 25th Divya Yuga, which would make Lord Ramachandra 13 million years old. Do you know anything about this 25th Divya Yuga? Where it comes from? We're in the 28th now, I think. 28th, yes. Yeah. Because when Kukudmi went to see Brahma, he was told that while you've been up here with me for a few minutes, 27 Divyugas have passed. So Kukudmi lived at the beginning of the Manvantara. And then... Oh. Does he say that for other avatars too? Ninth or 13th?
Yeah, I think it's 9th or 13th. But it may
that would make him, you know...
He's quite a lot older.
80 million years old or something. Anyway, okay.
Also in the 5th canto, the prayers of Hanuman to Lord Ramachandra.
In the 5th canto, yeah.
Yeah, 18th or 17th chapter. Prabhupada does comment on that a little bit. Or maybe something. Maybe
Anyway, it's at least... I mean, it's almost a million years old, or maybe up to 80 million years old, Ramachandra's appearance. What was the point I was making? We got off the track. Yeah, but why did I bring in the history of the human race? Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, avatars actually appeared in this world. That's the basis... That's the phenomena on the basis of which the Vedic rishis could make scientific observations, because there's actually something that happened. And some of it happened millions of years ago. Fortunately, some of these rishis are very old, millions of years old, or rishis back then did the observation, millions of years ago, or thousands of years ago. They actually saw the avatars. They talked to them. They had relationships with them. So they simply recorded, analyzed, and recorded their observations scientifically. If we accept that the avatars actually could have happened, and what is being described is actual experience, observation of the rishis, then we have scientific literature here. Just as scientific... as an ephemeris that tells you where the planet Mars will be next month. Because for the last thousands of years, astronomers have been plotting the orbit of Mars, and the mathematicians have decided that the orbit of Mars must follow certain formulas based on all the places they've seen Mars in the last 10,000 years. And they can tell you where Mars will be. The books are there, the ephemeris. You can look up where Mars will be on your birthday in the year 2050, in the ephemeris. All based on scientific observation and some mathematical generalizations. Like that, this Bhagavatam description of the appearance of Krishna and the Puranic descriptions and epic descriptions of all the various avatars of the Lord, as presented in the authentic form by Srila Vyasadeva, we should accept this as scientific history. History tends to be very unscientific in the real world. Because historians have imperfect vision, they have imperfect collection of facts, very limited collection of facts, then they have to make up a story of what they think happened based on the little they know. And there's always the bias, the prejudices of the historian distorts the history. Things are there that didn't actually happen that way, not exactly like that. Things that never can be proven or just inserted to make a consistent story or to follow the bias, the agenda of the historian. You can look at the history of World War II. In the American textbooks, and the history of the same war in the Soviet textbooks, and you get a totally different story of what happened and how it happened, and who actually won the war, who actually defeated the Nazis, and how they did it, and who was good and who was bad. You get different versions of history from each different historian according to his agenda. So history is not at all scientific. It's storytelling. It's fiction making, myth making. But this is a different kind of history. This is not imperfect history. Vyasadeva can see the past, present, and future. And he sees it with clear, perfect vision. He's also expert communicator. He knows how to speak scientifically and poetically, just like Sri Jiva Goswami could write the Sandarbhas, and we've got our head full of Sandarbhas. You know what it's like. Whatever you studied in school that may have twisted your brain, you know, you studied advanced mathematics or engineering or whatever you studied, or you studied philosophy and read Wittgenstein, things that just strain your brain power. But Jiva Goswami can be worse than that. But he's also a sublime poet. What he's writing in the Gopal Champu, it's a whole different language and a whole different mode of thought. Similarly, Vyasadeva can be a poet and also a nitty-gritty philosopher and scientist, both. But he's not, the history he presents here is not the kind of fallible, very subjective history that we get in most so-called books of history. Here we have a perfect historian who was there for at least Krishna's pastimes, who could see the other pastimes of the other avatars with his perfect vision of past, present, and future, and who can describe it to us clearly without distortion and without imposing any material agenda, motivation of his own. This is perfect history. It's not mythology. It's not fiction. It's not hopeful attempt to support some religion of the next life that will keep us from feeling despair about the reality of our useless life. It's factual scientific history like you cannot find anywhere else. You cannot find truth in so-called history, only here in the Bhagavatam. This is the most scientific literature, and it's the most reliable. People have heard enough nonsense. They lived through Marxism and have had enough of it. The people, I don't know, the government wants to pretend to be Marxist in China, continue to pretend to be Marxist. But I'm sure the people of China have had enough of it, just like they had enough of it in all these other countries. And we've had enough in our so-called free countries. We've had enough of our so-called free discourse and this don't believe in anything. We've had enough of it. People have had enough of it. They want to hear. They want to actually have some reliable truth is what people are looking for. Or at least when Maya has beaten them a little more, they're going to be ready to hear the truth. Maybe not exactly yet. They're still intoxicated by their technological toys and their ability to stuff themselves with fast foods and other things that won't be sustainable for very much longer. Eventually, the people will have had enough around the world, and they're going to want to hear this Bhagavatam. And who's going to, when they come clamoring, teach us the Bhagavatam, who's going to teach it to them? This is Prabhupada's mission. People are going to want this knowledge. They're going to need it. Their lives are going to make no sense without it, and they're going to know it. And we and the generations in ISKCON after us have got to provide what they're going to be demanding. You know, you've been selling us these books. Okay, now we want to learn what's in these books. Tell us. You know, my grandson bought this book in an airport 50 years ago. Now I found the book wiped off the dust. And I want you, please, to explain to me, what is this book talking about? People are going to be asking us. And we have to be ready. When the world becomes serious to hear the message of the Bhagavatam, somebody, that means us, and our disciples have got to be able to explain the Bhagavad Gita to them. Okay. So I'll stop there. Any questions or comments? Yes.
One may ask question that in this world we don't have an experience of somebody being completely perfect, so he might argue with Sri Visadeva and other sages being perfect and being able to see past, future and present completely. So what we can say in this argument?
What can you do? A doctor may be very expert, but if the patient's even after coming to him and paying the money, they won't follow the advice and take the medicine and avoid eating the wrong things. If they won't listen to the doctors, then let them try to find another doctor. If you don't believe Vyasadeva, find somebody else you do believe. If you don't want to accept this religion, okay, find something else. Do something. I don't think it's our program to forcibly convert people to devotees of Krishna. You can't do that. That we just, take over the government, we'll have a monarch, and he'll round everybody up and tell them, okay, you ready for initiation? Or else I'll cut your head off. That's not the way. I don't think it's the way we should be making people into devotees of Krishna. They should voluntarily agree to do it. And if they don't want it, then okay, find something else. What can we do? At least we should make it understandable and attractive so enough people will want it, accept it. We have to make it understandable and attractive.
So maybe we can tell that at least theoretically accept that it's possible. And then try to follow and see what happens.
Yeah. Anyway, most people will do what everybody else is doing. What's popular and seems to be authorized, seems to be the right thing because they saw it on TV. And their favorite, star does it. They'll want to do it also. They'll just follow the other masses and they'll follow the so-called leaders. We have to get the intelligent class of men, the people who are other people listen to. We have to aim for them, especially. At least Prabhupada wanted to. If the leaders of society accept this movement, if the intelligentsia and the leaders accept, and other people will accept, Prabhupada would always say that. But Prabhupada didn't go around, licking the boots of politicians and movie stars. He spoke the truth to whoever would hear it. And whoever would accept it, they become the de facto leaders of society. They're the Brahmins, the ones who would listen to the message. No matter what background they came from, they would become empowered to become the leaders of human society. Okay, anything else? Mate Prabhu.
Prabhuji, is there any insight why the end of Krishna's pastimes comes in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita?
Well, I don't know. I just get a few threads of ideas. One thing is that the Bhagavad Gita seems to be starting where the Mahabharata finishes. It's like a continuity from one book to the next. I think that's just for establishing the storyline. There's the skeleton or the external side of the Bhagavatam, which is the apparent structure of it, the plot. A Purana tends to be formless. It's just an encyclopedia of all sorts of information. But better than that is to try to create some coherence in it. So the Bhagavatam has a kind of coherence. Just like Kalidasa's Mahakavya, Raghuvamsha, doesn't have one plot. It doesn't have one hero. It's unusual. It's a genealogy of one generation after the other. The ancestors of Raghuvamsha. You know, Bhagiratha and Amshuman, Bhagiratha, these kings, Raghu, you know, one after another. So the only plot is the genealogy. Bhagavatam is like that. The plot of the Bhagavatam is the line of kings from the sun god and the moon god. So there's devices. It's an external device. The essence of the Bhagavatam is not the genealogy. It's just the external thing that ties it together in a literary form, gives it some external coherence. Similarly, the historical connection between Mahabharata and Bhagavatam is just it's just external. It's just a literary device to give it some external form. It really doesn't have to do with the essential message of the Bhagavatam. Krishna is transcendental no matter what side you look at him from his front or his back. At the beginning or the end of his pastimes is none different. So spiritually it doesn't make a difference whether we read about this leela, that leela, in the middle and the end or the beginning. But to give it some external form, this curious thing is there, that it begins with the end.
Okay. You mentioned the literary device.
Also, I'm sorry. Also, there's emphasis of this viraha bhava, the anticipation that Krishna is going to leave this world. And that leads into the appearance of Bhagavatam. Krishna Isodamo Pagate, or Dharma Kam Sharanam Gata. When Krishna leaves, now that Krishna has left, where will Dharma go to take shelter? The answer is the Bhagavatam. So the introduction of the Bhagavatam, the introduction of the appearance of the Bhagavatam, the story of the appearance of the Bhagavatam, is based on the story of the disappearance of Krishna. And Bhagavatam fills the gap when Krishna is gone. So it fits together as a storyline. Yes?
It's a bit related. You were saying literally devices. I was hearing some conversations from some...
That doesn't mean, in this case, that it's not really true. It's just a literary device. It's true, yeah. And it's also presented in a literary form. That's what the case here.
So I was hearing a conversation that, for example, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on Bhagavad Gita, he used lots of the dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna. Yes. He adds a lot of dialogue. And we see also often in the commentaries, even we were reading recently in the Sandarbha, the Purvapakshas are like conversations. Sometimes, like we were reading, Brahma was praying, and then Narayan answers, well, like he asks a question and then the answer is given. So the devotee was saying, well, I understand this is like it's a literary device. It might not always, be that there was the actual conversation.
Right. It's not intended to in that situation to mean that Krishna actually asked those questions.
Yeah, or Arjuna.
In between the verses.
Yeah, but it's okay. It can be some.
It's like
an internal conversation. Like, for example, we may say some things, but
mental.
We understand.
It went on mentally. Krishna could have thought that, and the commentator Sridhar Swami or Vishwanath has enough intelligence to know if Krishna opened his mouth, what he would have said.
So he was saying that because he writes lots of books that are prominent. Actually, Shiva Ram Maharaj was saying that. And he says, so I use it also in my books, this literary device, that I took some pastimes on the side, but they're according to Siddhanta, but it's to prove a point. That, okay, maybe I'll have a conversation between two parrots or between some gopis.
And he clarifies that at the beginning of his book.
Yeah. So, okay, I just wanted to
right. In Bhagavatam,
to make it more clear,
Bhagavatam is generally historical. The actual text of the Bhagavatam. The commentaries may introduce some guesswork, some what Krishna might have said, That's commentary, but the text itself of the Bhagavatam is mostly actual history. It's another question whether they all spoke in verses, you know, whether it was all in poetic form. You know, generally, I think Bhagavatam, Sanskrit is easier to speak in verse than it is in prose, generally. But anyway, that's another question. But the events, the descriptions are all, the facts are all historical, not made up. What might have happened. No, it's what actually happened. And it, even if it's not exactly the same words, it's what so-and-so said to so-and-so. Maybe in different words, maybe not. With rare exceptions, we have the fiction of Puranjana told by Narada, but it's marked as a fiction. It's obvious it didn't really happen. It never happened. There's no such person, Puranjana. But we're told that. Otherwise, we're not told that, and we have to assume that it's all factual history throughout the Bhagavatam. Commentaries is a different thing. There the commentator has some liberty to make up conversations that may have never happened, but just what Krishna could have said, what so-and-so could have said.
And I was discussing with another devotee that sometimes these are like the internal conversation. For example, we might speak if between good friends, they might say some words, but internally there's like a certain understanding. So that could have been brought up by Vishwanath Chakravarti.
Yes. Okay. You could look at it like that. What you could say, maybe you could say that it's actually exactly what Krishna was thinking. But Vishwanath Chakravarti doesn't tell us that. He doesn't say Krishna thought exactly these words. He just, you know, normally when you see that kind of made up conversation, Purva Paksha and answer, it's a device that a commentator is allowed to use. This is his understanding of what was the idea behind what was said. And he presents it as a conversation that may have not actually have happened. That's accepted in commentaries. Maybe Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, with his mystic vision, was able to discern exactly what Krishna was thinking. Or things that were said and were never recorded. Maybe, but the normal device in commentaries is the commentator is allowed to make up conversations as long as he sticks to the facts. Yeah. Oh, okay. Oh, yes. So it goes over here.
Is it possible to find factual proofs of the existence of Vedic civilization in history, geography, and so on? Well, I always thought that spiritual wisdom is more important than chronological order and so on.
Well, you could argue that we don't care. Maybe there's something under the ground we could dig up, but it's not our concern and not our method. You could say that. Or someone could try to dig up something. But so far, they haven't dug up much that really points to real Vedic civilization. The Harappan civilization doesn't look very Vedic to me. Yeah, they worship some, you know, unicorn bull. I don't, you know, it doesn't see, some bull with a horn in his head, one horn, you know. You see this bull all the time. And it doesn't look that Vedic. Maybe it is Vedic, and the language they spoke isn't Sanskrit. It's something else they can't identify. So that's not it. They found Dwarka under the sea, but this doctor, what's his name? Dr. S.R. Rao, I looked up on him. He found what he says is Krishna's Dwarka, but it's dated 1500 B.C. It's 1500 years too young to be Krishna's Dwarka, unless Krishna only lived 1500 years ago, which means that the Bhagavatam isn't telling us the truth about the dates. Yeah, Kali Yuga began 5,000 years ago, not 3,500 years ago. So it's some later Dwarka, according to the archaeologist. He's a very respected archaeologist, one of the most respected. He's probably dead already. But and the other thing about His claim to have interpreted, to deciphered the Harappan script, most of the linguists don't agree. They respect his methods as very, very sensible, but that his conclusions are guesswork, and he doesn't claim to have deciphered much of it. And there isn't that much there. It's mostly just people's signatures. You know, they don't have any extended text more than 27 characters. I tried to go to Mathura yesterday, and I just couldn't get to the museum. But I wanted to go see how deep have they dug in Mathura. They have they can't trace it back further than Buddhism, what the history of Mathura. But if they dug deeper, what could they find something? Mathura city was refounded by Shatrughna. It's described in the Mahabharata that the people in Mathura came asking Ramachandra to protect them from Lavanasura, the son of Madhu. Madhu was a pious demon, but Lavanasura was a complete rascal, and he set up his camp in Madhuvan. So the people there came to Ramachandra asking for protection. He asked his brothers, who wants to go kill this demon? And Bharata wanted to go, but Shatrughna asked, let me go, I want to do it. So Bharata had Shatrughna coronated as the king of Mathura and sent him to go kill the demon Lavana. So Shatrughna did this and refounded the city of Mathura, which had been evacuated or destroyed by that demon. And that happened either 871,000 years ago or 13 million years ago. So if you dig down to that level, and they had a city there with walls made out of real bricks or stones, you should be able to find some remnants of it. If you make sun-baked bricks, they disintegrate. But solid bricks should last at least 50,000 years, if not a few hundred thousand years. What to speak of solid stones? There should be some evidence if they dig in the right place and dig deep enough. If somebody wants to do that, they can.
Do we need to do it, or is it our responsibility?
I don't know. It's very expensive. And, when you dig down in the ground, you get all sorts of dirty bones and dead carcasses and things. I don't know if we want to be actually digging in the dirt. And we have 6 acres out there. I was even thinking we could, dig a hole and see what we find, but I don't know. Out there in the sun, and we dig up some dead dog, and I have to pick it up, and I think let somebody else do it. Yes. Yes, sir. Oh, we got to stop. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.